This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company. For more information and links to all our great podcasts, visit hartmanmedia.com.
Welcome to the Holistic Survival Show with Jason Hartman. The economic storm brewing around the world is set to spill into all aspects of our lives. Are you prepared? Where are you going to turn for the critical life skills necessary to survive and prosper? The Holistic Survival Show is your family's insurance for a better life. Jason will teach you to think independently, to understand threats, and how to create the ultimate action plan. Sudden change or worst case scenario, you'll be ready. Welcome to Holistic Survival, your key resource for protecting the people, places, and profits you care about in uncertain times. Ladies and gentlemen, your host, Jason Hartman.
It's a 10th episode show, and we talk about a topic of general interest, but this general interest topic ties in very much with my pandemic investing philosophy, because we are going to be talking to the lab girl, Hope Jaron, and we are going to be talking about her new book, The Story of More. One of my predictions, and why this is very much related to that and to the economy and my investing strategy going forward, is that I believe that people are going to dramatically change their lifestyles coming out of this crisis. And I think people are going to lean toward a simpler life. And as they lean toward a simpler life in an economy, and I'm speaking of the U.S. economy, not the global economy per se, in an economy like the U.S., it consists of 70% consumer spending. If people live a simpler life and they spend less, what does that mean to the economy? What does it mean to the stock market? Well, it means less. So there you go. Less is less. There's an old saying in architecture, less is more. And I agree with that in architecture and government, for sure. Less is more. This is the story of more. So we'll see how this plays out going forward. I think you'll be interested in this interview with Hope today as she discusses some of this, and it's really very timely. Okay, before we get to that, let me share with you a couple of economic data points, and they also kind of relate to the topic of today, the story of more. So a lot of people are very concerned that they will lose their job. And I'm looking at an interesting chart here, and this is from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. And this is a chart entitled Expectations of Losing One's Job Versus Leaving Voluntarily. And it what this speaks to is, you know, when you look at the probability of this and what people are thinking about, what their worries are, what their concerns are, what their emotions are, and you see how this is massively flipped on its head. Because before the pandemic, people were kind of thinking, well, we are in a booming economy, love him or hate him. Donald Trump definitely gets a significant amount of credit for that. And they were thinking, well, you know, I've got my choice. The job market is strong. I can leave. I can look for something better. You know, they're thinking about their employer. I can better deal you. I can just better deal you anytime I want as an employee. But wait, that has really, really changed, because this chart shows that now the expectation of leaving your job voluntarily to better deal your employer has dramatically flipped on its head. And now a huge, huge increase in people thinking that they are on the verge of losing their job, okay, and getting laid off or terminated. Another chart I'm looking at is quite interesting. We've talked a lot about the inventory shortage in real estate and the housing shortage in general. Of course, we've been talking about this for many years because there has been a very significant housing shortage and a shortage in inventory of properties. And, you know, hopefully on our last couple of webinars, we've helped you with that as we want to, as your guide, guiding you through this crisis. And we've presented more inventory in several Alabama markets, brand new inventory, nice new homes, beautiful properties, and then also new inventory in Jacksonville, Atlanta, and other markets, you know, reach out at jasonhartman.com or contact your investment counselor if you're already working with them for more information. And if you want a link to the replay of either of these webinars, you know, we can get it for you. We got to go in, you know, do some special things, set it up for a replay, but we're happy to do that for you if you are a serious, ready, willing, and able buyer or investor. We'll be happy to do that for you. So just ask your investment counselor or contact us through jasonhartman.com or at 1-800-HARTMAN. Any of those places, any of those ways will do. So check this out. Real estate listings have declined. I mean, I hope you're sitting down because this is absolutely shocking. This is a one-week moving average on a year-over-year comparison. Real estate listings have declined by not 20%, not 30%, not even 50%, but a staggering, an absolutely staggering 70% decline in listings versus this time 1 year ago. Okay? Talk about a way to keep a shortage of inventory. Man, that is absolutely staggering. And that was published in Wall Street Journal, according to Black Knight. Maybe the last one, and then we'll get to our guest. So this is interesting, as we've talked a lot about mortgage forbearance. And by the way, you know, many of you know, you've met her at our live conferences and heard her on the podcast, but my Aunt Joan, or Joni, she likes to be called Joni. My Aunt Joni, who is a very rich real estate investor, she's been doing it for decades, and she and her late husband, John, my uncle, had been buying up properties for many, many years. Now they're doing it the old-fashioned way, you know. They're buying them all in their neighborhood in Sacramento. The rent-to-value ratios are not good at all, as you can imagine. But hey, you know, look at income property is such a durable asset class. You can not optimize very well. You can make a lot of mistakes. You can have a lot of bad things happen to you, you know, bad tenants that don't pay, you know, people that damage your properties, you know, crappy property managers. You can just have a lot of bad things happen. But the asset is so resilient through recession, through bad tenants, through bad managers, through bad decisions on your own part when it's your fault. You're doing the bad thing, you know, and hey, many investors are their own worst enemy, aren't they? So it's such a resilient asset class that either way, you know, you just keep doing it long enough and you're just going to end up really rich. So congratulations, you're going to be really rich. You just got to stick with it. You know, it's a game of staying power. That's what real estate, the game of real estate always is the game of staying power. So Aunt Joni, I was talking to her last night, and she said that out of her 80 plus properties that she owns, I said, Joni, how is your rent collection doing? You know, you got these properties in the Socialist Republic of California and in maybe one of the worst places, Sacramento, nonetheless, which is terrible. You know, very left-leaning, tenants play games. That's the seat of the government. It's the state capital. And, you know, there's a lot of pretty aware people in Sacramento with knowing that they can work the system, if you will. And in California, very tenant-friendly and landlord-unfriendly. So that's a place where people can work the system and work you pretty bad, okay? But but Aunt Joni said that in the last 2 months, where people have been talking about rent strikes and the California legislature has been talking about all these new laws that are very anti-landlord, she said she's only got one tenant that couldn't pay. They lost their jobs in the pandemic and they couldn't pay. And then she's got one other tenant out of, now this is out of more than 80 properties, okay? One other tenant who has not paid all the rent. It's a partial payment. So, you know, I say that's pretty good. And then I talked to my mom. Now, mom doesn't have quite as many properties. I think she's up to like 19 properties now, my mom. And you've heard my mom on the show. Many of you have met her at our live conferences over the years. Many times she's been there. You know, both Aunt Joni and my mom have been on stage talking about their real estate investing. And mom said that she's getting 100% rent collection the last 2 months. Okay. So, you know, this rent strike problem that we're reading and hearing about, I'm finding, and this is anecdotal, I don't have a real survey on this, but I'm finding that with my own portfolio and with the investors, you know, you that we're talking to, that we're hearing from, that this is really a problem in the multifamily housing category. And that's one of the things I've always told you, that if you own an apartment complex, just remember, you do not have a real estate investment in the typical sense. You have a business. You have a page on Yelp where people are reviewing you and giving you a one-star rating or a five-star rating, and where tenants are all talking with each other and forming their little mutiny groups and saying, hey, let's gang up on the landlord. Let's do a rent strike and, you know, mutiny, mutiny. And they do that. That's one of the problems with multifamily properties, with, you know, an apartment complex. You got all these tenants talking to each other. In fact, many of them make private Facebook groups, and they all go into that Facebook group and they complain about how bad the landlord is and how bad the management is and how everything needs to be remodeled and repaired and we're not going to pay our rent this month and all that kind of stuff. You got a bunch of single family homes that you bought at jasonhartman.com. Guess what? Your tenants don't even know each other. They don't talk to each other. They don't know each other. And that's good for you, right? Because they can't mutiny. They can't gang up on you if they don't know each other. So, you know, we're hearing about these rent strikes. We're hearing about forbearance. And we're going to see a big increase in mortgage delinquencies and some rent delinquencies, too, especially in the multifamily sector. Remember also that in the single family home sector, you just have a better quality tenant. Of course, there's an exception here and there, but by and large, your tenant quality is just so far superior in a single family home than it is in an apartment complex. You just get better people that pay their rent. Okay. So this chart says the extraordinary increase in unemployment is signaling a spike in mortgage delinquencies. Okay. It's not happened yet. Okay. But they think it's coming. Because they look historically at this chart from 2000 until 2020, it doesn't say exactly, but it probably goes back 60 days. I bet there's probably a 60-day lag here, or maybe 30 days, but 30 to 60-day lag time in the reporting. And the mortgage loans past due over that 20 years and the unemployment rate, I mean, they pretty much track each other very closely. So when unemployment is down, delinquencies are way down and people mostly pay their mortgage. It's never 100% people paying their rent or their mortgage. And when unemployment goes up, the delinquencies go up. So I'm looking at the chart and wouldn't you know it, right there during the Great Recession, you know, you see 2008, you see a big spike in unemployment, you see a big spike in delinquencies. Imagine that, right? And it pretty much tracks. I mean, that this chart is very, very consistent where one line tracks the other, and they believe that there will be a spike in mortgage delinquencies. And what's that going to mean? Well, one thing it will mean for certain, you know, you can take this to the bank, take it to the bank, is that those people that go delinquent on their mortgages will ultimately end up being kicked out of their house, and it will go back to the bank and be sold at a foreclosure sale, or be sold at a foreclosure sale, I should say. It'll be one or the other. And they will not be buying another house because their credit is beaten up and they will be renting and you will be there to provide rental housing to them. So congratulations. One more comment. I did a really interesting interview today. Actually, this will probably be a webinar because it's sort of in-depth and complex. And I interviewed a market researcher who was quite fascinating. He was a speaker at one of my mastermind groups recently. And so I invited him on to be interviewed by me. And we looked at all kinds of charts and graphs. And we talked all about the migration trend and how it is already happening. And this huge influx is already beginning. And folks, many places are still under lockdown, okay? And we're already seeing it. And this trend is going to get a lot, lot bigger. And you, dear listener, dear investor, clients of ours, you are going to profit from this very, very handsomely. So congratulations in advance, because there is a tidal wave, a tsunami coming at the type of property, if you're listening to my show and you're a client of ours, that you own already or you're about to buy. So congratulations and lots more on that on upcoming episodes and webinars and so forth. All right. I'm talking too long. As usual, it's time to get to our guest. Let's talk to Hope about the story of more and really think about how this totally interplays with my prediction of how coming out of this, people are just going to live a simpler life. So, you know, if you deal in luxury properties or if you're a yacht broker, of course, the super rich will always just do what they do. But that upper middle class, I don't think it's going to be the same. I think people are going back to basics a little bit. And I think there's a real cultural shift that is happening. We'll see. You know, maybe I'll be wrong, but I doubt it because I'm usually right about everything except, well, interest rates. I've been wrong about that for a long time. But hey, you can't win them all, right? All right. Without further ado, here is Hope. It's my pleasure to welcome Hope Jaron. She is an internationally award-winning and acclaimed geochemist and geobiologist at the University of Oslo, Norway. I've been there twice, by the way. Known for her work using stable isotope analysis to analyze fossil forests dating back millions of years. She has won many prestigious awards in the field, including the James B. McElwain Medal of the American Geophysical Union. She's number one best-selling author of Lab Girl and her most recent book, The Story of More, How We Got to Climate Change and Where We Go From Here. Hope, welcome. How are you?
I'm just fine. How are you doing?
Crazy times we're living in. And of course, I'm referring to COVID. We don't know when anybody will be listening to this episode necessarily. It might be years from now. But just give us a little flavor as to what's going on in Norway with the coronavirus pandemic.
Well, it's maybe not too different from what a lot of your listeners are doing in that I'm home every day. I'm working from home. We go out and we buy food and we go to the pharmacy, but we're really encouraged to go out as little as possible and certainly not to mix, you know, mm-hmm. in a personal way. Mm-hmm. And that's been in effect now 10 days. I'm 10 days into that and we're not expecting to get the all clear for some time. Of course, I don't have any idea what the rules are going to be, but the kids are home, the parents are home, the workers are home, we're sitting tight.
And the economy has come to a grinding halt. And we're going to talk about that relating to the story of more. I think that's a pretty good segue. But I got to ask you, is yours a government order or is it a suggestion?
It's a suggestion.
Okay.
And it's a suggestion that people are following very closely.
Yeah, right.
The thing to remember about Norway really is that it's a country of 5 million people.
Right.
So it's a country with a population the size of Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
So organizing that many people, getting them on board, having their coworkers, you know, all my coworkers are doing the same thing. A lot of us work for the schools or other, you know, centrally governed workplaces. And so it's a recommendation, but the spirit is to follow that recommendation pretty closely.
I would think that in Norway or any of the Scandinavian countries, I've been to them all, that, you know, people would just listen without much, you know, debate. I can totally see that. Okay, well, so this is interesting because one of the ways, of course, people have been judging what's going on in China is by simply looking at the smog levels. And that's an indicator of how active the economy is. And tell us about the thesis of your recent book or your latest book, The Story of More. Have we all just gone crazy with consumption or what's going on in the world?
Well, there was a period of time where we were awfully, awfully good at making things. And my thesis is sort of that instead of taking all that imagination and going on to the next step of making things, we simply made more and more and more and more of what we could make. And we figured out better and better ways to get people to buy that more and more. So we've kind of edged ourselves into a corner where we know how to make things very well. But we're sort of trapped in having to consume more than we need to consume, almost just to get rid of all these products.
So tell us what you mean by that. Is it like
the issue of, okay, we've got all this junk. Now we got to go to the container store to figure out how to store it and organize it. what do you mean?
I like that. That's kind of having more stuff means you have to have still more stuff. That's sort of what you said. And that's very nose on. One great example is grain. So the population has doubled, you know, since I've been alive in the last 50 years. And that was a crisis around how are we going to feed all these people? That's a lot. 7 billion people is an awful lot of people.
On balance, I do want to note that Mr. Malthusian economics fame said that in 1798, too. And apparently we got past that hurdle. I want to say that. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. And the book goes through that, too. I mean, people have been worried about population growth ever since they could count each other. In Mesopotamia, you know, 2,000 years before Christ, people were talking about, can the earth take, you know, another 100,000
people? Oh, really? I didn't know that. That's fascinating. Oh, yeah. Okay.
That's something that every single generation wrestles with. But the really kind of magical thing that happened about 50 years ago was that our plant scientists, our agricultural scientists, working with our farmers and our ag stations, came up with a way to grow several times more food on the same plot of land. So,
as much as I love to hate this company, is Monsanto largely behind that?
It's a part of it, but it's really kind of the end of the story.
Right. Okay.
In that, to make a bushel of corn, for example, and a bushel is about what it sounds like. It's about a 50-pound basket, about like what you check into the airport. Now, to grow a bushel of corn 50 years ago, that used to take a field the size of about a basketball court. Today, it takes just a little over a parking space to make that much grain.
Okay.
So we have been doing this wonderful, wonderful thing, and we do it in three ways. And part of it is the improved breeds that now Monsanto has more or less of a monopoly on selling, these very improved breeds. Mm-hmm. But it also comes from better herbicides and better pesticides, better irrigation.
Well, they've also got Roundup, so yeah.
Yeah.
Cancer-causing Roundup, by the way. Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, absolutely. So we ended up with double the population growth and triple the food supply. Now, that was an amazing, you know, an amazing way to sort of solve this problem. But then the question became, what are we going to do with all this food? Like corn is this great example because it's found new. We're actually hard pressed to consume all this stuff we make. We take part of the corn and we turn it into fuel. We take food, edible food, and we turn it into fuel for cars, right? And we take it and we turn it into flat out sugar. We put it in Coca-Cola. We basically take all the nutrients out of it and turn it into just plain sugar. And then that goes into everything. Corn syrup goes into your ketchup, your salad dressing,
your sodas.
So we're kind of, we created all this more, and now we're desperately trying to find ways to consume it. Mm-hmm. And of course, that's driving vast overconsumption, most of which is just not doing us any good or is doing us active harm. So the big question, the way I see it, is can we learn to live with less? Can we learn to invent other things and invest in those that will help us not do more, but actually do less? It's kind of a different mindset, and it takes a while to wrap your mind around, actually.
Okay. So, well, you talked about the food part of it, and I was going to say, only half jokingly, sadly, is that Americans have figured it out. They just store more food in their bodies. And so we have a massive, pardon the pun, obesity epidemic, a massive one. But, you know, with sugar, there are obviously distinctions to that. But you're talking about every kind of material, every widget of every kind, food just being one of many, right?
Right. So we consume three times the number of fossil fuels that we did 50 years ago. We consume 10 times the amount of plastic. We consume 14 times the amount of seaweed, if you can believe that.
I love seaweed salad. I eat it all the time.
You only about 10% do you eat. Okay. 90% of the seaweed that gets harvested ends up in things like shampoo and hand lotion, cosmetics, and processed vegan foods, right? Because you need a substitute for eggs and mayonnaise and things like that. Mm-hmm. And so we are turning food into chemicals and then turning those chemicals into ourselves. Mm-hmm. And our health indices are decreasing, and the toll on the earth is as great or bigger and bigger every year.
Is there anything we're using less of or doing better at? Or, you know, it's easy to say, okay, well, you know, bad people over consuming and pillaging, but are we using less of anything? I mean, we're using more plastic and more this and that, but in anything less?
Well, that's a big point, is that we aren't bad people, you know, and a lot of this snuck in on us when we didn't realize it was happening. You know, if you think about the after school snack you had when you were a kid versus now, and how much plastic you have to open up in order to do the one versus the other. A lot of these things didn't seem like big changes in our lives. And we certainly didn't go to the grocery store and say, oh, I'm picking that because I don't care about anything and I want to wreck everything. But we did sort of trap ourselves into a system where plastic packaged products were kind of all that we could buy. What we're doing right now, and this has been really interesting, and it's certainly something I didn't expect when I was writing this book, is we're having this kind of interesting, and also, of course, people are ill and dying, and so it's not at all positive. But at the end of it all, we hope and pray that we'll go back to a new normal, and then we can have some interesting discussions about how much of all that stuff that we did was actually optional. How much of this traveling around, meeting face-to-face, eating out in restaurants, you know, burning gas in our car to get there. How much of it was optional?
A lot of it is just sort of like laziness in a way. Well, I mean, I don't want to say it's lazy to travel because that takes kind of a lot of energy, actually. But it's we sort of just go along with what we're being sold by Madison Avenue, or now it's social media and keeping up with the Joneses. And you know, people, I think human nature's always been that way, but it seems as though we've had this explosion of it, right? Maybe because we're just more connected and disconnected than ever at the same time. And, you know, maybe psychologically, like we're all looking to fill a void. But we're all connected, so we see what everybody else is doing. That's the keeping up with the Joneses concept. And then, of course, we get constant bombardment of media. And, you know, it's maybe not a very mindful way to live. Is that what you're saying? Or
I think you hit the nail on the head. It's wonderful to talk to somebody who says what you just said. It really is. It's you know, and we know that we have to have a job. We have to have a paycheck. We support our families. You know, we need a place to shelter and we need food to eat. But do we need all that 10 times over? And is it making us any happier? You know, just like you said, sometimes it seems like acquiring all these things is actually us trying to fill a hole with something. And it doesn't seem as if it's working. I mean, it's really hard to measure how happy people are, but there are international reports that have tried to do it. And, you know, they publish the happiest country in the world and all that sort of business. But when they look at
and they'll
the
say Denmark,
general,
but I don't know. I kind of take issue with that. I was just in Denmark several months ago and I'm not so sure, but go ahead.
Yeah. If you like spicy food, you're not going to be very happy there. People have the ability to be happy everywhere. But in general terms, you know, if you look across particularly the last 10 years in America, people are saying very adamantly that they're not as happy as they used to be, even though all this consumption is still going up, even over 10 years ago. And so that leads me to believe that they're not linked. You know, there isn't some amount of extra plastic doodads we can buy that's going to fill that particular hole.
Well, this is what economists call the law of diminishing marginal returns. And I think that's, you know, to put it in economic parlance, that's what we're talking about. You know, all this stuff makes you happy to a point, and then it actually becomes a burden after that, or it makes you less happy, or maybe just being on the treadmill makes you less happy. I'm not sure. I get the idea. I'm not saying I figured it out, but do you want to elaborate on that?
Well, I'm really excited about the last third of my book, which is really about making small changes that might turn into big changes. Just considering, you know, the way we consume and the way we eat and all these things, they're actually just 100 little choices that you make over the course of the day. Sure. And you make them yourself. You know, we have quite a bit of agency as consumers and as, you know, we have some, you know, we're constricted in some ways, but there's sort of a guide of, you know, if you wanted to use less energy, which of the items in your house uses the most? You know, even when I meet people that say, well, I'd like to cut down on my energy use or my footprint or whatever. What's the best way to do it? How do you get the most bang for your buck? Is it by turning all your lights off when you leave the house? Is it by this or that? Well, it turns out that a lot of it goes back to your hot water heater. You can use a smaller one or keep that water just a little cooler. That's where you're going to save money and save energy. And you can do it for a lot of reasons. You know, it can be a household project. And if some folks are doing it to save a few dollars on the electric bill, that's just fine. If other folks are doing it because they're part of the Greta generation that wants to, save the world from climate disaster, well, that's just fine, too. I mean, I think that thinking about these things and thinking about what we can do as individuals, starting with small and getting bigger and bigger as we go, I think that's a way to start to talk about it.
But no one's going to get too excited about turning down their water heater. I mean, there's got to be some bigger things here that are, I'm looking at your table of contents, right? So, gosh, I don't know where I should go in here, but, you know, I think the food thing is one that, you know, if you look at the COVID thing, for example, right? And you mentioned in Norway, people are cooperating pretty well. And in the U.S., people are cooperating. And, you know, it's a big country, okay? 327 million people, but there are these outlier idiots, right? But by and large, or now the new term is COVIDiot. Okay. The new slang. Okay. For people who infect other people or, you know, go and spy all the toilet paper. So there's none left for anybody else. Right. Yeah. You know, but by and large, people are cooperating, but you know, maybe it's not because it's just sort of the right thing to do. It's because they have their own health at stake. You know, it's like, maybe they don't care if they pass it to anybody else, but they care about themselves. So I think food is a big one. That's kind of like an easy fix too, because it's for you, you know, it's, you can be selfish and think about, okay, well, I want to eat better because it's good for me. And, you know, if it has a side effect of being good for the environment, great.
Yep.
You know, the real motivation will be for looking in the mirror and feeling better and having more energy and all that kind of stuff. So maybe you want to address some of the food stuff.
Yeah. Meat is a real, you know, it's like these things. It's like, does your light bulb matter more than your hot water heater? No, it doesn't.
And the light bulb doesn't take much energy anymore, thanks to human ingenuity and LED lighting, right?
Hardly any. Yeah. It's your AC. It's your furnace. And also with your diet, you know, meat is your big lever right there.
Right.
What I try to encourage people to think about is it's not an all or nothing thing. You don't have to choose to be, you know, a vegan or an omnivore or, you know, it's not that the difference between 7 servings of meat a week and 5 servings of meat a week is huge in terms
of huge for your health too.
Yeah. Absolutely. Right. Yeah. So it's not about joining one of these clubs and picking up the torch. It can be about, you know, one meatless day a week adds up to a massive amount of food left over for somebody else.
Let me share a couple of thoughts on that, if I may. And we talked off air about them. When I was in my 20s, I was a not too strict vegetarian for 6 years. And then I came off of it and I actually felt better eating some meat. But I think by far, at least Americans consume way too much meat. And I'm not omnivore. I think we're meant to be omnivores. But meat should be the celebration concept. Think about it. If we were all living in caves, hunting is a hard chore. That's difficult to hunt and catch an animal. They're fast. Okay. And so that was the rarity. And, you know, maybe the whole village got together and had a celebration when there was a kill and they ate the animal. But it wasn't 3 meals a day. I don't think the body was designed to consume that much animal product. And of course it's better for the environment. You know, I remember I interviewed John Robbins' son on the show, but years ago, I followed John Robbins' work and I'd go see him speak. And he wrote Diet for a New America, a great book. He talked about the number of gallons of water it takes to produce a pound of edible fruit, vegetables, or meat. And the meat is just, it's insane. It's so inefficient to feed an animal vegetables and then slaughter the animal and eat the animal. You know, you could just eat the vegetables and it's just a much more efficient thing, eating low on the food chain. It's so much better for you. It's better for the planet. It's just better for everything. What I would say to people is just eat meat once a day. You know, this whole concept of like, oh, we need all this protein. I kind of fell for that for a while too. You know, protein is a big molecule. It doesn't circulate in your body very well. And if you overdose yourself on protein because you're trying to bulk up or whatever, you know, you need protein. It's the building block of your muscles, sure. But too much of it is counterproductive. It'll make you get cancer. It slows down your circulation.
And what I try to emphasize to people is it's not that we're on the heavy end of meat eating. It's that we're way past meat eating. So back in, you know, the wartime recommendation, you know, back World War II, when they tried to get folks to cut down on things for the war effort, they advised about 3.5 pounds of meat per family per week as a perfectly healthy way to go. And there were lots of families that were able to adhere to that. Today, we live in a society where we've got an awful lot of folks eating about 3.5 pounds or nearly that per day in terms of animal products, right?
Yeah, that's crazy.
So we're past being omnivores. I mean, it's we're really, really very much off the charts with this sort of thing.
Yeah.
And it's not, as you say, it's not doing us any good. And we're getting to the point where we need to think about why are we doing this? How did we get this way? And do we need it to go forward? And the other thing we do is we throw away about 40% of the edible food we prepare.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, that's terrible.
So in order to keep the food, we just make so terribly much food. In order to keep that wheel turning, we can't even possibly stuff it down ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's not like we're not trying, right? We have to actually, the amount of food that's edible that we throw away in the first world is enough to feed the everyone who's undernourished on the planet. There's about a million undernourished people, and the amount of food that gets thrown away is equal to what would bring them up to a mark of nourishment. So we live on a planet that all the suffering that we see is because of our inability to share, not the Earth's inability to produce. And I remember when I figured that out from lots and lots of numbers and crunching lots and lots of data, that's true with respect to energy and it's true with respect to food. And it kind of puts us at a crossroads. Are we just going to keep going toward the more until, you know, almost, do you remember that Monty Python movie where that guy literally
blew up
until
you? Yeah, it was disgusting.
I think of that sometimes, you know, is that where could it possibly end?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's quite something. It really is. Any comment on sugar and the different types of sugar and, you know, anything like that? Anything more you want to say there?
Sugar is interesting in that it's very, very cheap to make. And it's very easy to put into food. And it's driven the sales of certain things. When we figured out how to make corn into sugar, it was as a syrup, and it was very, very easy to get it to go into liquid form, much easier than the sugar we had before that. And that's when we saw the explosion of soft drinks and 2 liters for 99 cents. Yeah. And it became available. It became everywhere. And it became kind of the default drink.
Mm-hmm.
And there was about, you know, now soda consumption is starting to go down a little bit, but I think what would we have without having all the sugar and everything? You know, it's and the sugars, these sugar compounds were literally invented in the 1970s. It's something we hadn't known before. So we've got all this great technology, these great ideas, these great investments, but it seems like we've put them to some unfortunate uses. Do you agree with that?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I do. And I think one guideline should be to simply look at the way nature operates. Like the example I gave of eating animal products. Animal products are not easy to get in nature. Animals are fast. They're hard to catch. Okay. We've gotten good at it in the modern era because we've got all sorts of tools to take advantage of the animals, right? Which is sad. But sugar is also hard to get in nature. And we should eat and consume proportionate to how hard something is to get in a natural way. You know, as much as I'm definitely not a fan of Mark Zuckerberg, I do like something he said, that he eats animal products, but only what he kills himself. Mm-hmm. So he doesn't do that very often, I'm guessing, at Facebook headquarters. So, you know.
Some of us would be hopeless at that. But
right.
If I had a friend that could do that, and then maybe I could make preserves out of cherries from my tree, we could have a good trade going on.
No, I just think, I think the environmental movement is largely an over-politicized, and I think science, sadly, has been over-politicized to fit an agenda. I don't like any of that. Okay. I don't agree with a lot of the, you know, sort of environmental movement, if you will, that's become this like political element. But I do agree with just being sensible and doing it for your own health. I mean, this is just logical. Okay. It's not, you know, it's not like you have to become a zealot of anything, right? These are just reasonable, logical things. Okay.
I think you're exactly right. I mean, there's a great example of that, and that's the global warming. And that was a label that was thrown out. It was thrown out by scientists who knew that, you know, the Earth's atmosphere was changing and heat balance was going to change. Global warming was a very, very simple way to simplify that. And it was put out as a buzzword under the assumption that the public couldn't understand anything more complex than that. It was disrespectful, and it was kind of taking the easy way out. What we're seeing now is, you know, these weird freezes and these intense storms and strange blizzards. And what it is that, yeah, the atmosphere warmed, but it warmed in these pockets, and these pockets get pushed around in weird ways. Like you've heard from your weatherman, you know, a low pressure, a high pressure, a low pressure thing is moving in and all this kind of stuff. And what that warming did was it got everything churning around again faster. Well, that takes a little more time to explain, and you've got to have a little more respect that people are going to understand that. But we now have this weather weirding, I call it, which is the result of that moving around air faster and in different ways than we've seen before. But we don't have straight on warming, which they took the easy way out as making the suggestion. And it eroded a lot of trust, and it became very political. And a lot of people wanted to be on their soapboxes and look smart and all that kind of business. And I mean, I agree with you 100%. This is why I'm not a member of the IPCC. I don't get asked to join those kind of clubs, because we as scientists, we need to really talk to people instead of preach at them. And that's another thing that I'm really quite proud that this book does well. It talks to people with a level of respect and understanding, and a hope that they'll find something interesting in there for them.
Yeah. Well, good stuff. Give out your website.
It is thestoryofmore.com. We'll take you to everything you need to know about me and the book and the other books.
All right. Great. That's thestoryofmore.com. And Hope, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thanks again.
Thank you so much for listening. Please be sure to subscribe so that you don't miss any episodes. Be sure to check out the show's specific website and our general website, hartmanmedia.com, for appropriate disclaimers and terms of service. Remember that guest opinions are their own. And if you require specific legal or tax advice or advice in any other specialized area, please consult an appropriate professional. And we also very much appreciate you reviewing the show. Please go to iTunes or Stitcher Radio or whatever platform you're using and write a review for the show. We would very much appreciate that. And be sure to make it official and subscribe so you do not miss any episodes. We look forward to seeing you on the next